Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I said I'm ready, but I'm really not. No, I actually am. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wait, that was a laugh from Not Molly Wood.
Nope, I am not Molly Wood.
Wait, you're not?
No, I'm Rima Jerez. I'm filling in for Molly Wood today, which feel like big shoes to fill.
They are very big shoes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't know what actual shoe size it is, but Molly's a presence. Molly's a presence.
Yeah.
So you know what it is, right? It's Make Me Smart. It's all about tech and economics and culture. Rima is moonlighting, as it were,
yes,
from her brand new Marketplace podcast called This Is Uncomfortable, Money and How It Messes with Life, which is, by the way, awesome.
Oh, thanks.
I should tell you. No, it's great. It's really cool. It's
yeah,
really cool.
Appreciate that plug.
There was one on crying at work that I was in.
Yeah, listen to that one. Second episode. Yeah, this is my first time co-hosting Make Me Smart. First time. Hopefully not the last.
No.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous, but, you know, I have you here, so, Kai.
You know my rule on the radio, right? Don't think,
yeah,
just talk.
Yeah, okay, I'm just talking.
All right?
Not thinking.
Don't think, just talk.
Ooh.
I do it every day.
Yeah, so I have you, I have our listeners, and I think I'm on the spot for the tagline right now.
You are,
which
go.
Which is, none of us is as smart as all of us.
There you go. So here's what we're going to do today, and it's going to be kind of a group effort here, driven by a thing that I saw on Twitter. I went back and looked it up just before we came into the studio. I saw it on the 5th of May. There was an article from The New Yorker about how there's not as much studying of history in American universities as there used to be. And I said on Twitter, I was a history major. This really matters because if you don't know where we've been, you can't figure out where we're going. And I got like 1,000 retweets and 5,200 likes, which, I mean, for me is a lot, right?
Yeah.
And it really resonated. And so I thought it might be interesting, given this moment in our history right now, for us to talk about this on this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that same article. It was kind of wild. It was like a 30% drop in the number of people getting history majors since 2011.
Yeah.
Which is wild. I had no idea that was the case. But yeah. And I think, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more than just the major today.
Well, it is more than just the major, because here's my theory on this, and we're going to get to our guest in a second. But my theory is, and has been on this podcast since we started doing it, and it's part of why we do this podcast, actually, that context is everything.
Mm.
And in my brain, history is context. And all of that stuff really, really matters, because it informs the current debate on where we are in this country, where we have been, and then hopefully, as I said, where we are going.
Right.
I mean, who knows?
Right. So to talk about that with us, we have Brian Rosenwald. He is on the line. He is an editor of Made by History, which is a blog that partners with The Washington Post, and it puts current events in historical perspective. He is also the author of the new book, Talk Radio's America. Welcome, Brian.
Brian, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you guys?
I'm good. I'm good. Let me climb in and have you test my premise. Why, to you, does history matter?
Well, I'm sitting here nodding along. Obviously, your listeners can't hear this, but I'm nodding along to you because I think it's exactly right that it gives you context. And I'll add a second thing, which is it allows you to interrogate that context, to really investigate and think about, well, how did we get to here? Why are things happening in this way? Why are people seeing things in totally different ways? And we see it almost every day now. You know, it seems like there's a different story from the president's 4th of July address to Joe Biden and busing to, you know, the not lack of equal pay for the Women's World Cup team. You know, these are just some of the topics that you can say, well, there's a lot of history to this that matters and that affects how we understand them, how we see the present and the future, and how we have a dialogue in a pretty fractured country. Where we understand what people who don't agree with us think and why they think that, and where we maybe have a common set of facts to have these discussions.
Yeah. And I want to get into some of those examples you just mentioned. But like, I want to know, like, do you feel like there's an actual decline in historical thinking in our society today?
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's a decline of critical thinking, of evaluating things, you know. And one thing that I think is always surprising to people when I've taught classes, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who think that the job of a history teacher is to make sure that students learn facts and dates and things like that. But our goal is often, how do we get you to think critically about material? Hmm. How do we get you to evaluate what an author is saying, where they're coming from, what their biases might be? And bias is such a loaded word now, but I just mean, you know, do they think that politicians should be central to a story versus activists? You know, that kind of thing, not so much political bias. But also, what was driving historical actors, really thinking about their behavior and, you know, what their goals were. And so we do a lot about thinking and writing and being able to make an argument and analyze things. That's a lot of our goal, what we're trying to teach. And people have sort of seen that they're focused more on pre-professional degrees and things like that. But there is something that's been lost, because that is something that is really, really important in our society.
So let's get to the present context, right? And you mentioned it, so I'm going to riff on it for a little bit. The 4th of July celebrations at the Lincoln Memorial and President Trump's desire to, number one, put himself in the middle of that, but number two, also invoke America's military might. And I'm going to throw you the question, and I'm going to state a historical fact, and then we're going to have a conversation. So there was much uproar. Mm. About this thing, right? About, first of all, the president speaking on the 4th of July at the Lincoln Memorial and politicizing it, but also this idea of the tanks and the flyovers and all of this. And I point out this historical fact. Dwight Eisenhower's inaugural parade had tanks in it. John Kennedy's inaugural parade had tanks in it. FDR's inaugural parade, one of them, had tanks in them. And yet everybody, mostly on the left, actually, because it's President Trump, lost their minds. Discuss.
I mean, I edited a piece that ran last week that explained that, first of all, the 4th of July has been politicized since before America was a country. Mm-hmm. Mm. And they were using it to help advance the cause. And since then, everybody who has a cause, from segregationists in the Deep South to civil rights movement to you name the movement, has tried to wrap themselves in the 4th of July. And presidents, this is not the first president to do something like that. You know, Richard Nixon did it, and several others as well. And when you go beyond that, it's also the average 4th of July celebration that people partake in their own local towns. Those things are politicized. We just don't notice it. Things like Lee Greenwood's song, God Bless the USA, the uniforms and costumes and flags and all this stuff. It is political. Not in a partisan way, but it's political in terms of forwarding our government and, you know, sort of not questioning things. It's not like we sit there on the 4th of July and say, well, where are we not living up to our ideals?
Okay, but wait. Let's go to Lee Greenwood for a second, right? Has that song not been appropriated by Republicans and conservatives?
It has been.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see this every campaign where you'll get some song that we've misunderstood, whether it's Born in the USA or Independence Day. There was a big Rolling Stone article on Martina McBride's song, Independence Day, which is about domestic violence. And it's turned into some sort of 4th of July patriotic anthem and been appropriated on the right. You know, you get this every campaign where people take these songs and make them into something political. But, you know, the thing that, and the left did go absolutely crazy over this, as though Donald Trump was the first person who's ever done this, and we've never seen anything like this. And in reality, everything that we do on the 4th of July has a bit of political context in terms of sort of adhering to our norms and reinforcing a certain patriotic ideal and the valorization of America. But there's no nuance, there's no context. You get people on the left, I had them come at me on Twitter when I shared this article, you get people on the left saying, well, everything's different now, or America has failed at all these ideals. Right. And when you say to them, well, wait a second, America's also done these amazing things, they get angry. And if you point out those failings, the people on the right tend to get angry. And nobody wants to actually say, hey, let's drill down into this critically. Let's recognize the good. Let's recognize the bad. And let's evaluate what our country has been and what it can be and what it should be and what the ideals should be.
Hmm. You know, I want to talk about another historical reference, too, that's been making the rounds lately. and it's comparing the immigration detention centers with the concentration camps.
Speaking of loaded terms, right?
Yeah, with the concentration camps at the Holocaust.
And how the Jewish community has come out and said,
right,
don't use those words, because the Holocaust is a separate deal and we're having an ahistorical debate.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, no, that's exactly what's happening. And so there are all these parallels that are being made. And so obviously it's a serious analogy. So I'm curious, first of all, what you make of those, you know, of that analogy. And generally, like, you know, when is it appropriate to make these kinds of historical parallels?
Yeah.
So I'm an American historian. So what I've done is rely over the last couple of weeks on my colleagues who study the Holocaust, who study European history. And most of them have said, you know, there is something to this comparison. What is critical about understanding it is that concentration camp does not just mean death camp. That there is a broader context and a broader history of concentration camps that is not just the Holocaust. And I think that, you know, certainly we want to be careful with historical analogies because you can go too far and there are these fault lines. You know, even as the Jewish community is kind of divided somewhat on political lines over this, you know, there are people who are upset by this, who say, well, what you're doing is saying that immigration detention centers are as bad as these death camps that killed, you know, relatives in my family and things like that. And so you want to be careful of those kinds of feelings and sentiments and whatnot. But what the analogy, you know, what analogies help us to do is understand the present, is understand where things may go or what the dangers are lurking. You know, to use another American example, we have the internment camps in the, you know, early 40s, where we've almost universally now decided that as a society, as a country, the government's apologized that this was a terrible chapter in our history. This was a mistake. At the time, we thought this was a necessity for security. And there was a lot of racialized feelings that fueled that. But, you know, there was a sense that the security of the country was at stake and we have to do this. Ideally, what we do in this kind of situation is learn from it. Is learn from the mistake we made there, is learn, you know, how 50 years from now, Americans might look back on this episode in our history and to understand it. And, you know, what historical context is really good at, and I think we really need it in the Trump era, is understanding what is new and novel. And sometimes new and novel can be great, but where is it dangerous? And understanding where there are these parallels that might inform what we should do now or what we should think about now. Not even what we should do, but how we should think about the situation. Where are the pratfalls? Where are the moral lines that we might be crossing? Where are the things where we might have lost the bigger, broader perspective on things?
So look, to that point of bigger, broader perspective, do you think in this era of Twitter and nanosecond news cycles, and a president of the United States who can redirect the entire media apparatus in this country, minus, of course, Marketplace and public radio, with a 14-sentence tweet, do you think we have the capacity to learn and gain that perspective?
That's a hard question.
I know.
I tend to think the answer is no.
Yeah.
Just and because...
Right. And so then are we hosed? That's the question.
Well, it's a question of whether we want to fight back against this tendency. And we have to, first of all, understand that all history is not created equal. You know, I think, according to Amazon, like the best-selling history writer in America is Bill O'Reilly. Well,
he has
a perspective.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah. All right, we're going to have to look that one up, and we'll let you know. But, wow.
Yeah, but, you know, that there's a guy who's selling best-selling history books. But he's got a perspective. He's got an agenda. And one thing that I find on Twitter that is frustrating and is dangerous is the number of times that a historian will say something and the number of people who come up to you, you know, tweet at you and say, no, you're wrong about this. You don't know what you're talking about, you know, all this stuff. And there is, it's a weird kind of sense that, you know, you don't go into your doctor and when your doctor says to you, you know, you need to do X, Y, and Z. You don't say, you know what, doc, I think you're wrong. I was on WebMD last night. I know this better than you do. But with historians, there is a sense that everybody feels like they know history or that they have, you know, an understanding of it that is good enough to let them challenge any sort of person who says something about history that they disagree with. And it's, you know, what we have to say, we have to commit to saying, everybody's going to have their own interpretation. That's why we still debate a lot of these things. But everybody, we've got to agree on a common set of facts, and we've got to agree to understanding all sides of history. And if we don't want to do that, we really have a problem as a society, because there's also a sense out there that history is static. In other words, well, these events happened years ago, they're over, so we can't possibly understand them differently. And I'll give you a great example. when the debates about busing were happening in the 1970s, you heard a lot about de facto segregation versus de jure segregation. De jure being that you had these laws in the South that separated white students from black students, and it had separate facilities. The idea was that de facto just happened naturally, that people, you know, moved in different neighborhoods, and that therefore if you had local schools, you were going to have segregated schools. Well, what historians have uncovered since then is that there were a lot of government policies and real estate industry practices and things that led to those segregated neighborhoods, that this wasn't just people choosing to live separately. And that there were a lot of policies that kept African Americans out of suburban areas, out of suburban schools, and that our segregated schools owe as much to policy that the, this distinction of de facto versus de jure really doesn't hold water. But if you learned, you know, if you were alive in that era or you learned about that distinction, there might be a thought that, you know, this is how it was. Now, wait a second. Why are you challenging that? And the answer is that historians are digging in archives every day. They're talking to people. They're studying documents. They're studying government policies. And we're interpreting things differently. We're understanding things differently. And we historians debate and disagree over interpretations every day of the week. But we have to agree on a foundation, and we have to agree that history is something we can keep learning more about. And we have to agree on wanting to at least see the other side, or we have a real problem.
And now, and then I'm going to get out of the way and let Rima ask her question, but and now here we are in presidential primary debates having a conversation about busing policy from 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And people are looking at each other going, wait, busing? What was that? Remind me. And Joe Biden's candidacy conceivably hangs on policy decisions he was making 40 years ago. Anyway,
yeah,
that's what I got.
That's so real. Well, you know, so to me, it feels like there's a huge thirst for history in some ways, right? Like, you see all these history podcasts, you see all these documentaries that are trying to make the subject a little bit more fun, a little bit more digestible, something that you can just consume on your commute. So I see all these things. I'm like, okay, maybe there isn't like a, you know, maybe there isn't a decline in history. Like, maybe we are interested. But I'm curious what you make of all of that, you know, just the changing landscape when it comes to these things, including your own blog.
It's encouraging. It's encouraging that people want to learn. We obviously as historians have to do a better job of writing for the public, of engaging the public, of getting ourselves out there. Because otherwise, if we vacate the playing field, then the people who are going to be doing history are either going to be people who have an agenda or people who mean well, but may not have the same perspective, to be able to find things. And you know, you've seen things, over the last couple of months where you've had journalists who have delved into history and have misinterpreted something.
Yeah.
And historians have said, whoa, wait a second. Mm. You know, it happened with Cokie Roberts on abortion. It happened, I think it was Naomi Wolf who got corrected on the air about something she just misinterpreted. And, you know, one thing that people don't know about historians, I'll have this all the time where somebody will ask me about a fact or a date or something, and where you have to say, you know, we're specialists. Just like you see with doctors or lawyers, we have a really deep knowledge about our own areas, but there are thousands of history books coming out every day. And I mean, I wish I could read all of them. If someone could give me that skill, I would love to be able to, you know, read that fast.
Well, that's what's so daunting.
That's right. That's right.
And the thing with this stuff, what I say to people is, yes, I am all for history podcasts. I am all, there are some great ones out there. I am all for long form journalism delving into history. But, you know, I'll go back to busing. There's a lot of context. There have been stories I read on Joe Biden's record about crime. Mm-hmm. But there's a broader context in literature about crime and why Democrats took the tack they did, where the American public was coming out of the 1960s, what the political demands were. And that's important context in understanding his decision making. And we don't see as much of that because that's something that historians know, that literature. Historians can call upon that. So what I say to people out there is, yes, read history books, listen to podcasts, read articles, but just be aware of, first of all, who's writing those. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe Google the author, try to find out where they're coming from. Understand that there may be this deeper thing. And, you know, there's so many historians on Twitter. Kevin Cruz is obviously the biggest name from Princeton who has developed a huge following. But we're out there. We want to answer questions. If people have questions, try to find things from academic presses. Some of those books, I know I made people just cringe. A lot of people out there who remember books from college texts and things like that. They say, oh, I don't want to do that again.
I'm trying to sell history here, Brian. Come on, man.
Right. But and you know, a pitch that takes us back to the topic of history majors and history classes. Mm-hmm. If you're a college student out there, take those classes. Yeah. They're going to help you to understand how to think. They're going to make you a better businessman, lawyer, doctor, whatnot. They're going to make you a more engaged citizen. If you're a parent out there and you have a student in college, encourage them to take those classes. I know there's this temptation to say, especially as tuition costs rise, you know, yeah, go take those business classes or go take those pre-med classes. But as Kai has found, those history classes are useful for you. They're going to help you in ways that you're not even sure
get you a job in public radio these many years later. That's what they will do for you. Brian Rosenwald is the editor of a blog called Made by History. It partners with The Washington Post. Current events in historical perspective, which is what we were trying to do today. His book, by the way, is called Talk Radio's America. Brian, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Brian.
Great talking with you guys.
Bye.
So there we go.
That was
my little thing on history. Yeah. If you are a history major out there, write to us, you know, voicemail us.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah. It's, what is it? MakeMeSmartAtMarketplace.org. And we'll put it on the podcast.
Yeah. All right. It's time for our break. And then we do a thing that you all call fixations. It'll be great.
I never really liked that name. I figured I'd say that. All right. Here comes this thing.
Bye.
It's catchy little ditty. We're back. It's me today with Rima Kreis from the Marketplace Podcast. This is Uncomfortable Money and How it Messes with Your Life. Check it out.
Yes.
Molly, what I will tell you, has survived her trek into the Montana wilderness. I saw her on Instagram the other day.
Yeah.
They had to turn back because there was so much snow.
Oh, I didn't even realize she was in Montana.
Yeah, she was like all hell and gone Montana, camping and stuff. I think it was supposed to be like a week, and they went 3 days and ran into too much snow.
Oh,
so
my
they
God.
Turned around. But she has survived.
Oh, so she'll be back.
And she'll be back.
Don't worry, y'all.
All right, what do you got?
So, fixations.
So first of all, you're actually prepared. Ms. Wood.
I am prepared.
Ms. Wood, usually, regular listeners will know, either has two or none.
No.
So what are we talking about?
Taking it seriously. I don't know if this article is the most serious thing, though.
Okay.
But it's interesting, and I was thinking about it. I read it last week, and it is about screen times.
Oh.
So I love thinking about like how much we're spending on our phones and how
God.
They're taking over our lives.
Do you do the screen time function on your iPhone? Do you?
Yeah. And I do it when I want to like feel horrible about myself and then I look at it.
Why do you do that? I don't understand.
I'm like, why am I spending 5 hours on Instagram?
Feel horrible about yourself? What is that?
Well, it's shocking. Like when you you're like, am I a monster?
Yeah.
Why am I not looking up? Anyway, so there was this article in the New York Times last week about how families, so this is in the context of like kids.
Right, and parenting and all that
stuff. Yeah, and it's so in the context of that, and it's how a lot of families and schools are hiring like so-called screen consultants.
you give your riff, and then I'm going to give my reaction.
Okay, so basically screen consultants. They come into schools, homes, and they help people, they help parents teach their kids to not how to be on their phones. And so, like, there's this one woman who I think charges, like, $80 to $250 an hour. And then parents will do, like, 12 sessions. So it's, like, that's a lot of money.
You are making that up.
No. And it's kind of funny because if you read the article, she's like, yeah, I tell them to, like, do you have a ball? Like, kick the ball. Do you have a jump rope?
Oh, my God. $250?
I know.
How about this? You ready? And it's going to take 4 seconds. So at $250 an hour, that's what, like, a buck and a half? Mm. Put down the phone.
Yeah.
Right?
Period.
Put down the phone.
Yeah. And I think like there are all these services out there.
Go play with the dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Just do it. Well, I think there are all these services out there that tell us to do things that are like pretty obvious to us. Do you know what I mean? But like this seems like so obvious.
It's so obvious.
It's so obvious. Yeah, there's value, nutrition, and lifestyle things. But like anyway, so there's this whole thing that's happening. And I think the idea is that like parents like have forgotten what it, like they haven't experienced what it's like
there are generational parenting things here, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there are parents now who, you know, were, you know, so let's say you're a 30-year-old parent and you've got a 5-year-old. So you probably remember when phones weren't a thing.
Yeah.
And so it's a new thing for you to parent this kid who picks up your phone and intuitively knows what to do with
and
it. And maybe
idea.
You know how to get over it, right?
Yeah.
But there are older parents, of which I am one,
right,
who will say, put down the damn phone.
Do you not let your kids?
Oh, they get all kinds of screen time. But you know what's really funny? Mm. They're well-adjusted, smart, bright,
they're
and sociable,
kids.
Right? Oh, no, they're a giant pain in my patootie 8/10 of the time. But look,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's life today.
Okay, so there's something else from
also,
that article.
Also, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. But anyway, get it.
There's something else from this article that I thought was really funny. Wait, what was it called? It's so there's something, have you heard of the Wait Until 8th Pledge?
No.
So I think it's like this movement where you promise complete abstinence from your phone until 8th grade.
From your phone.
In case you did not know that.
This podcast is completely different with you on it. I'm just saying. Anyway, go ahead.
And yeah, and then I think there was this one parent who was quoted that said she can't, her daughter can't have a phone until she goes to college. So that's a little.
Ooh, that's a little tough.
Until
that's a little
18.
Tough. So we gave the marker for us was, and this is more than probably anybody wants to know. The marker for us was 6th grade because it's 7th grade. They go to a different campus where they're not within walking distance and they're in the high school and it's a bunch of things. But they all got basically flip phones, right? Not smartphones.
Oh, so they can't go on the internet, the World
Wide
Web.
Until the fourth child came along. And in 5th grade, my wife and I just surrendered, and we were like, here's your damn smartphone.
Yeah. Just, like, stop bothering us, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and look, she's the smartest and most sociable of all of our 4 children, so go figure that
interesting.
Out. Anyway, whatever. That's a good article.
Interesting.
Send us your thoughts. MakeMeSmartAtMarketplace.org. This one will get a lot of feedback.
Yeah, I want to hear what y'all think.
Yeah.
Would you pay someone to do that?
No, God, no.
All right.
There might be people who will. I don't know.
What's your fixation?
So I'm going to be very quick because I've said this before, but the president of the United States has made a habit of beating up on the chairman of the Federal Reserve, as we all know, Jay Powell.
Mm-hmm.
Central bank independence globally is a big issue. God, I sound so boring compared to yours. Jesus. So look, here's the only thing I want to say. What the president is doing to Jay Powell and to the Federal Reserve matters. But thankfully, for the first time in a good number of years, the Congress of the United States, in an article today in the Wall Street Journal, which is why I bring this up, says that basically Congress is not going to put up with the president beating up on Jay Powell and firing him, which I think is promising for this economy, promising for the Congress of the United States. It is, however, a one-off. So we'll see. Anyway, that's that. That's that.
That's interesting.
That's my very boring thing.
No, it's an important thing.
Thank you. From your phone.
The Fed is important.
The Fed's important. All right, mailbox. Here it is. Save me from myself.
Hi, Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, we are going back to the land of CEO compensation, which was it last week? 2 weeks ago? Somebody up there tell me when it was. 2 weeks ago. All right. It was 2 weeks ago where we talked about CEO compensation as part of a bigger series we're doing on economic inequality in this country. Randy Avis sent us a voicemail, says he's an average worker, and he had this to say about the pay gap between, or the pay ratio rather, between CEOs and everyday workers in their companies.
I listened with interest to your recent podcast on CEO pay, and I certainly agree that pay disparity is a real thing. However, when I hear the term wealth tax, I cringed.
Okay, so why? And we're going to need a follow-up voicemail on this one because I want to understand why you cringe. And we should say that our guest in that podcast, Heather Boucher, suggested a wealth tax perhaps. And Elizabeth Warren has talked about a wealth tax on the campaign, like on the way, way high earners, right?
And people have supported that.
And people have totally supported it. In point of fact, a lot of Americans support a wealth tax, right?
Yeah.
And just to square the circle here, if you think back to history and the Gilded Age and how income disparity led to a lot of really bad things in this economy, there is a case for leveling things out. I don't know how you do it, but certainly taxes are one of them.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear his pushback on that because, there is like some valid pushback in terms of whether or not it would actually work or generate enough revenue or, you know, all that stuff.
Totally.
All right, so I have some listener mail. Rodrigo Sala, he wrote in and asked, is there a quote-unquote fair ratio when it comes to CEO versus median employee pay?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough, right?
Yeah. There isn't, but I don't think there's any right answer. But apparently cities have been, some states have been trying to figure it out. Portland did something pretty groundbreaking recently, and it passed legislation earlier this year that taxes companies that pay their CEOs 100 times or more the average worker.
Right.
And then there are a few, like a handful of states, California, Massachusetts, Minnesota, that have also introduced similar.
Right. And you can see how that breaks down on political lines, right? California, very blue. Minnesota, sort of purplish.
Yeah.
Massachusetts, same deal. So it's, you know, I don't think you're going to see those in like Texas.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no right number on this one, right? There just isn't. Daniel Schlossberg, he is a CEO of a family-owned publishing company, works with authors who earn more than his family's profit from their business, from their books. And here's what he has to say about narrowing that gap.
I'm distressed. Our profit is more than 500 times the royalties of our lowest paid author. I want a fairer system, but it seems some of the inequality is baked into the somewhat winner-take-all system we live in.
I don't think it's somewhat. I think it really is. So this is a really unpopular thing to say, but maybe your lowest-paid author needs to write better books. Right? I mean, you know, that's one solution, right? Mm-hmm. That's the market-based solution. And, you know, write in and you know, at me or whatever. but look, here's what's happening in this economy, right? The owners of capital are getting almost all of the proceeds from the growing economy, and the labor side of this equation, which are the authors, in this specific example, it's, you know, unfortunate for this author, but they're the ones who are losing out. And until there is some systemic restructuring, and if you look at the politics of this moment, Elizabeth Warren is the one who's out there now saying, we have to break up these big companies. We have to have a wealth tax, right? They are the ones, and Bernie, to a lesser leftist degree, are saying the same thing. We have to fundamentally restructure this economy. We can't nibble around the edges anymore. And we're going to see how that plays out in a year and a half, 16 months, whatever it is.
All right. And then it's time for the Make Me Smart question.
Yeah, buddy.
So the question is, what's something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? Alexis Koh, she's a historian based in New York. She is the author of several books, including the upcoming You Never Forget Your First, a biography of George Washington. It's a great title. It comes out next year. And here is...
From your phone. Sorry.
And here's her answer.
I thought that the only job available to historians, to people who had gotten master's or PhDs, was teaching. I thought that I could be a high school teacher or a college professor, and that was it. And I discovered after my master's, so well into graduate school, that I could in fact have a career in public history. And I happened to live in Brooklyn Heights at the time. And so I walked into the Brooklyn Historical Society and offered them my services. I didn't need to get paid at the time. I had a package. And I just thought, surely they have some use for a historian. And in fact, of course, they did. They had an entire program for graduate students. And I became an intern and then was put in charge of the interns and then hired on a freelance basis. And I found this entire life I didn't know existed, first as a research curator at the NYPL, then as an author, then as a podcast host. And so there's an entire world out there for history majors that people don't know about. And I hope that people learn a lot sooner than I did that there are far more available.
There you go. I like that.
Yeah.
That was good.
That was good. Goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
There you go.
Like the decline of history majors.
Yep, for sure.
You know?
For sure.
That might be part of the reason why people don't do it.
The Make Me Smart question, of course, is what is something you thought you knew but you found out you were wrong about? The voice memo goes to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, and don't forget, we've got a newsletter. It's really awesome, actually.
Check it out, yeah. You should
totally check it out. It's marketplace.org/newsletters, and there's nuggets in there for all kinds of people who are interested in history and everything else. Mm-hmm. So check it out.
All right.
Deep in, take a breath. I thought it was me. No, you go.
I did the credits.
Go.
Okay.
There you go.
So Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. And thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore, who are responsible for these cameras staring at me right now.
I know, right? You're like, I'm going to do radio or audio.
I know. I'm
not
going
to have to deal with it. I'm like, no, man. Audio, to quote Ira Glass, audio means no picture. All right. Yes, and also, in addition to all those other people, Rima Kreis, for taking half an hour on a Tuesday and just hanging with us.
Yeah,
it was great to have you. I really appreciate it. And once again, her podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, about money and how life messes with it. Check it out. It's something new from us, and I think it's really cool.
Thanks.
It's really cool. This week's program engineered by, stick your head up, Daniel. Daniel? Yes, Daniel Ramirez. Theme music was composed by Mr. Ramirez, also Ben Talladay. The executive director of On Demand, who's sticking her head in the control room right now, because, you know, she's got to swing by. Sitar Nieves, senior vice president and general manager, who occasionally listens to the end, is Deborah Clark. All right. We're done.
That's it.
There we go. That's
we
the whole smash.
That wasn't that bad.
36 minutes of your time.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Thanks.
Not so bad, right? You just came in here and talked for a little while.
Yeah.
Right?
That went by a lot more quickly than I expected it to.
Good.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.